There are some people out there who are so overtly narcissistic. They're so entitled. They're so abrupt. And it gets into this really tricky space of where entitlement overlaps with privilege, overlaps with narcissism. A lot of media is like that too. Because there's such cutthroat industry, what a person needs to do to get to the top of that pile is brutal. It's throwing people under the bus. Sometimes it's deceit. It's breaking rules. It's behaving unethically. And those industries tolerate it because they're often based on return. People will ask, why don't these places get rid of these people? They're doing so much harm. Like in an industry that's indexed by bottom lines, they're having to make a tricky choice here because nobody wants to kill the golden goose.
Dr. Ramani is a clinical psychologist, best-selling author, and world-renowned expert on narcissism, who uses social media to empower countless people by making psychology accessible.
Attachment and love are basic human needs. We want them. We want to connect to other human beings, whether as partners, whether as family members, whether as friends. We value social connection. We want to maintain attachments. Mm-hmm. And in that quest to maintain attachments, we justify, we rationalize, and above all else, we blame ourselves. Maybe I'm not being nice enough. Maybe I'm being impatient. Maybe I'm not being realistic. Maybe I'm being too demanding. Because by saying it's me, the relationship gets to sustain.
I'm Erica Kohlberg, and you're listening to the Erica Taught Me podcast. Hi, it's Erica Kohlberg. And before we dive into today's podcast episode, I have an exciting announcement that can help you save an extra $1,000 without having to penny pinch or change your lifestyle. On Monday, I'm running my free 5-day savings challenge, where you'll discover simple and creative ways that you can save extra money every month. And whatever you want to do with that extra money is up to you. I'll just show you how to save it. The challenge is totally free to join. All you need to do is go to erica.com/go. Erica is with a K, and you can secure your spot. By the way, these strategies that you're going to discover can help you easily save money, whether you're a budgeting novice or a finance expert. And they're going to get better and better throughout the week. But I have to tell you, I'm so excited about this and don't want you to miss out. In November of last year, we ran a savings challenge and had over 200,000 people sign up. And on average, people saved $1,005 that month through what they learned in the challenge. That means our challengers collectively saved over $200 million. So trust me when I say you don't want to miss out on this one. And the deadline to sign up to be part of this free challenge is Sunday, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. So make sure you secure your spot and get free access today. Again, that's erica.com/go, erica.com/go. See you inside. So can we start off with talking about what exactly is a narcissist?
Mm-hmm. So a narcissist is really a narcissistic person. And a narcissistic person is a person who has a narcissistic personality. And a narcissistic personality is a personality that's characterized by a person who has traits and patterns, including entitlement, grandiosity, self-centeredness, arrogance. There's a preoccupation only with themselves, especially if they're distressed. They can't notice anyone else. They often envy other people. They believe other people envy them. Very superficial, very status-oriented. And this whole, and very low empathy. So, and the tricky bit with the empathy, it's not even simple. You can't even just say it's low empathy. It's variable empathy. And it's always shallow empathy, right? And when you put all those traits together, that first of all, to keep in mind, those traits exist almost like a suit of armor against a deep insecurity and shame that exists within the narcissistic person that they don't ever, that is, in essence, it's so unconscious and so unprocessed. They're not aware that this is what's happening. So if anything sort of activates that shame or activates that insecurity, criticism, feedback, even they don't get the parking spot that they want, then that those uncomfortable feelings gurgle up, and you'll often see the reaction will be significant rage, either overt rage or aggression or passive aggression, like withdrawing or withholding or playing the victim. Narcissistic personalities then, that sort of translates, these traits translate into behaviors like manipulation, gaslighting, invalidation, mockery, contempt, betrayal, lying, cheating, blame shifting. They don't take responsibility. So you can see what this creates is a relationship that's incredibly unhealthy. But the tricky piece of this personality is that when you first meet these individuals, and often even not just when you first meet them, they can really turn on charm, charisma, confidence. They're often quite successful, successful in business, successful at dating. They're often overrepresented in leadership. They move through the world quite smoothly, and they sort of command almost any space they're in. So as a result, we're attracted to them. And because they hold these positions of power, they either A, get to make the rules, or people justify their behavior. So it's not as simple as this is an entitled person who behaves badly and says hurtful things, run away. This is a person who often holds a lot of cultural cachet or is very attractive to someone, but yet all these toxic traits are existing within it. And what that all does is it leaves the other person feeling very confused.
What are some strange ways that you can actually tell early on that someone is a narcissist?
Well, here's one for you. Watch how they drive. Narcissistic people, and at least a dozen studies have supported this, are very aggressive drivers, pulling up on people's bumpers, honking, cutting people off in traffic, driving too fast, even when a passenger's saying, hey, I'm anxious. In fact, that might even spur them on to drive even worse, and they might even make fun of the passenger for being nervous in the car. But that dangerous driving, to me, is one of those red flags that if you see it early enough in a relationship, that should be enough of a sign that you say, I'm out.
Are you going to find more narcissists in certain professions?
Heck yeah. In industries that are more competitive, more financially rewarding, more powerful. And that would be things like CEOs, law, media, entertainment, athletics, anything where, again, there's a big payday and a lot of power. But those are the flashiest ones. Don't count out things like medicine, high-level academia. And again, any politics, government, any of those places, you're going to see a lot of narcissism because it's power, it's control, it's dominance, or it's money.
And what determines, because these narcissists often have the charisma and they're very caring from the outside, what determines whether you get to see the narcissist's true colors or if you are shielded from that and only get to see the charismatic, charming part? Like, is there a level where they're comfortable enough with you or because they think you're a lower status?
Where it gets interesting, it's a great question, because does everyone ultimately see the full spectrum of the narcissist's behavior, good and bad? If you spend enough time with them, probably. But the way it works is that for narcissistic people, they always want to punch up, right? So they want, when they're with someone they perceive as having much more status, being much more sort of desirable, they will definitely put, they will not behave badly. And this is, it takes us to that issue of a lot of people say, well, maybe they can't help it. They can help it, because this is a person who, even if they're on the golf course with the CEO of their company who's criticizing them and giving them feedback they don't want to hear, they'll keep it together with that CEO because they don't want to be on their bad side. But the minute they come in the door from that golf game, will berate their partner. So they're able to maintain very separate behavioral repertoires and do this pretty regularly. But for narcissistic folks, the people who are going to see, if you will, the best of them are people, again, of higher social status, people who supply that they need and that they value. And so that's why early in a relationship with a narcissistic person, you're often going to see the best of it. If you hold power over that narcissist, for example, CEO, boss, a friend with a lot of money, power, influence, that kind of thing, they might see better behavior. If you have a more superficial relationship with them, so in other words, you don't see them regularly, that let's say the narcissistic person picks up the check regularly when they go out with a group of people, they're all going to think this is a great person. Oh, they're so generous. They pick up the check. Who doesn't like it when somebody picks up the check for an expensive dinner? The more time you spend with the narcissistic person and the greater the intimacy and closeness of that relationship, the more likely it is you're going to see the dark side of this personality style, which is why family members, friends, and partners and children are the ones who always see the worst of the narcissistic person.
So are narcissists smart? I mean, they know what they're doing. They know when that they can show their true colors versus when they cannot. They know when to switch it on and off.
It's not a knowing as much as it's a disregard. So I would say the knowing is that the narcissistic person with that CEO may actually be seethingly angry at that CEO and will say terrible things about that CEO to anyone except the CEO, right? Because they want to keep that good relationship with that powerful person. But the narcissistic person hates that CEO for pointing them out and all of that. But they know what good behavior looks like, right? Mm-hmm. They know they can't scream. They're not so impulsive that they would do that. Pushed enough, yes, a narcissistic person could snap with the wrong person at the wrong time, meaning start screaming at the CEO kind of thing. But by and large, what they know is they know what looks good, and they're focused on getting supply. So it's the, I want the CEO to like me. So I get, and the narcissistic person probably thinks they're smarter than the CEO and better than the CEO, and they're having to put up with the CEO's nonsense as a means to an end. Don't think there's any, it's not that they admire them. It's that they understand what they need to do to be able to get supply, whether that's a promotion, whether that's praise, whether that's money. So that's the one piece. So when it comes to other people in their lives, it becomes pretty clear, because of the way the narcissistic relationship works, they are such master manipulators that they know that these other people close to them won't leave them in most cases, right? Mm. Long-term committed partners, marriages, that kind of thing, family members. They sort of have everyone in their thrall. They're controlling everyone. So there's almost a contemptuousness they have of the people closest to them because they feel disposable. And everyone kind of won't leave because of that whole cycle of trauma bonding and that stuff we talk about. So there is, if you will, a knowing, but I don't know that it's so much about a smartness as much as it's a calculation. I need this person's supply, so I'm going to do what I need to do. I'm going to work this room this way, but I don't need to work the room at home. But it's not about working the room. When they get home, they're going to be cruel. A healthy person might come home after that terrible round of golf with the CEO and say, I just had the worst 4 hours. Do you mind if I go lie down? You know, I just need a break. Do you mind if I take a minute to myself? So there'd be a sense of taking responsibility and not lashing out at the other person. A narcissistic person is entitled, and they feel they have the right to lash out at other people. There's no regard for other people's feelings or needs. There's a lack of care, really. And it's a dismissiveness, like, what, you know, I don't care about your needs. It doesn't matter to me. And it's hard for, if you do care about people, which most of us do, it's very hard to get your head around that. But I want to go back to your point, Erica, about the smartness. Narcissistic people are often very smart. And that's what also muddies the waters even more. Part of that is about cultivating a muscle, right? So they'll get to, especially grandiose narcissistic folks, they will get to learn something really well. Even malignant narcissistic folks, they will learn what they learn and they will know it well. They'll be great at whatever form of business they know, or for medicine they practice, law they practice, cars they fix. Like, they will know their stuff. What does that do? That gets them supply. Like, it's kind of the smartest guy at this. You went to his own system, an admission. And it's very interesting what that smartness does. So many people will say, I didn't think this was such a bad person. They're so smart. To which I say, when the hell did smartness become a virtue? To me, smart is a parlor trick. Smart is intellect, but it's not a virtue. Kindness, compassion, respect, patience. Those are virtues. Smart is a skill, right? It's like being able to spin a basketball on your finger. I don't consider that a virtue either. And because narcissistic people, their quest for perfection, to look good to the world, they will often cultivate themselves as absolute subject area experts and be experts. Like, there's no, their knowledge of something is probably right. You know, they're on point.
And certain professions over-index in narcissists, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So think about it. In industries where it's more competitive, where there's higher status, where there are higher stakes, where it's more of a zero-sum game and winner take all, you better believe those are professions that are going to attract narcissists. You don't find a lot of narcissists in a pool of first grade teachers, okay? But where are you going to find it? Finance, media, entertainment, athletics, in the highest echelons of academia, medicine, law. That's where you're going to high status, politics, government, anything where there's a lot at stake, there's a lot of power, money, things like that at stake, and it is very competitive. You're definitely going to see that those are the professions that will over-index to that. Let's say if we were to spitball that the number of narcissists in the population, not I'm not talking about disordered or anything, like enough that you'd notice it, probably around somewhere between 1 in 6 and 1 in 8. So somewhere between, like, I don't know, 10 to 15% where you'd be like, ooh, okay, that's not okay. If you were to go into like a C-suite, 40%, 45%. I mean, you couldn't spit once without hitting someone like that. A lot of media is like that too, because again, these are people who are controlling the narrative. Mm. So, and because they're such cutthroat industries, what a person needs to do to get to the top of that pile is brutal. It's throwing people under the bus. Sometimes it's deceit. It's breaking rules. It's behaving unethically. And those industries tolerate it because they're often based on return. It's something I often call the golden goose paradox. People will ask, why don't these places get rid of these people? They're doing so much harm. I'm like, because they're making too much money. And in an industry that's indexed by bottom lines, they're having to make a tricky choice here because nobody wants to kill the golden goose.
Yeah. I mean, we had a partner at the law firm, I remember, so badly behaved. Like, he would get drunk at these parties. And one time he was wrestling one of the summer associates, like the interns that we had from these law schools. And his behavior was just horrific. But he was known as one of the rainmakers he brought in so much money for the firm that it just all got swept under the rug. No one ever said anything to him.
And that kind of mission creep, as it were, right? That people, that they keep folks like this on and they keep making excuses like, we need another year of these returns, or we have not found a group that we could replace this person with because we need these numbers. The mission creep is that at some point it goes one bridge too far, and then there's the legal challenges and what happens. I mean, we've seen this happen in media. I'd honestly say Me Too was not a women's movement as much as it was the narcissism movement. People were basically behaving in this untethered, facing no consequences way because they were deeply entitled. They felt that they could do those things. That's narcissism. That's where it's operating. And then we saw what happened. Good things, I think, you know, there's been some shifts, not enough, but some shifts in some industries. But at the end of the day, I can't tell you how often to this day, I look around in the spaces I interact in. And I'm like, okay, the person at the top of this org chart is narcissistic. Show me one where it's not. I'm always shocked when I see it.
How can you tell? I mean, can you meet someone and after an hour know that this is a narcissist?
It depends on the context. You know, I think that it's a certain arrogance to say, like, you know, people think I can always read the tea leaves, right? And it's very interesting because, you know, over the last few years, a situation that had developed for me professionally where I was brought an opportunity and I said, I'm kind of leery of that opportunity because I know that person's narcissistic. And like, you've never met this person. You don't know. I was like, hey, I did have a 5-minute conversation. You can't know in 5 minutes, Robin-y. I'm like, okay. And of course, since I've been so narcissistically abused all my life, self-doubt is like my fellow travelers. I'm like, maybe I am being a, you know, bad person. 3 years later, so bad. Like at the high, and it actually harmed me. And I didn't get too I told you so about it. A little bit I told you so about it. I said, I told you all this was a narcissistic person. I told you this. And they said, but I said, did you not read the book? Like, you know, I've written a couple, three now. And so that's frustrating because I think sometimes there are some people out there who are so overtly narcissistic. They're so entitled. They're so abrupt. They're so rude. You tend to see it in people who hold a lot of power. And it gets into this really tricky space of where entitlement overlaps with privilege, overlaps with narcissism, right? It can be sometimes hard to tease those things apart. But by and large, I tell people, context matters, right? So if you're meeting someone at a gregarious dinner party and you're not meeting them in sort of a competitive way, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like it's a sort of a socially lubricated space. It's going to take you much longer than in a place where you're being vetted and, you know, where somebody's is almost pushing you or they actually aren't worried about offending you. The best way to figure out if someone is narcissistic is when they are behaving as their full selves and there's a power difference between you and them, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
The more that's apparent, that's codified in the beginning, the more likely you're going to be able to figure out this person's narcissistic, right? Because it can take time. With grandiose narcissists, it's pretty obvious, right? They're dismissive, they're contemptuous, they're snobby, they can behave in an very entitled manner pretty quick in the game. I'm somebody who, when I meet charm and charisma, my ears pop up. like immediately, like all, you know, it's like, it's almost like I'm like Wally, like I'm like a character with all these radars popping out of my head, like, oh, charm and charisma, like all the radars are on, we've got a problem. And then I'm now studying the person like this. But if a person's not so charming and charismatic, I will sort of pull back. But what's harder to pull out is the vulnerable narcissistic folks, the people who are more sort of socially anxious, petulant, resentful, sullen, angry. They come off as broodingly angry, in which case, if you know what you're looking for, I actually, knowing what I know, they're a little bit easier to pull out because there's no charm and charisma. But I think for the average person, especially when we think of dating, that's where this most people want to know about this. Because so many people are engaging in online dating, and online dating is where narcissistic people flourish. The probabilities of running into narcissistic people while dating, especially in online spaces, has really skyrocketed. And so you are looking for consistency in communication. You're often not going to get that. It's either going to be too much or too sporadic. That's one thing to really look for when you're sort of in these dating settings. But I mean, I think all things being equal, it probably takes a few meetings to be pretty confident that this is what's happening. But I'll be frank with you, after you've met someone 3 or 4 times, you should have kind of a handle on it. Where I'll be frank with you, Erica, the higher you get in the social hierarchy, the harder it is to pick up a narcissist. The lower you are, and if you know what you're looking at, that's when you pick it up. And I always find myself at a unique advantage there because I don't come off as patrician or fancy or designer label. I'm not even well put together, which is actually kind of a superpower because I could be sitting in a room and people actually probably think I should be fetching them a drink. It's the best position in the room because it's in that position in a room I've been able, because they don't know. I don't walk around with like a necklace around me saying PhD or New York Times author. I just sit there. And that has allowed me to spy many a narcissist ahead of schedule. So I kind of keep dressing shabbily. It's working real, real well for me.
It's a good strategy. Someone thought maybe like a week ago that I was a waitress at this restaurant. I was asking for directions to the bathroom. So I had to like look around and look for the bathroom and show them the way.
Oh, no, I get it. There's actually a grocery store. It's actually not even a very nice grocery store in Los Angeles. And the past 3 times I've gone, like, can you tell me where the cereal is? And I oblige. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's aisle 3. So, yeah. I mean, in all seriousness, though, as people get higher up in the status chain, the narcissistic people are reaching up to them. Does that make sense?
So then you're not going to see their personality.
You're not going to see it. That's right.
Something you said that caught my attention. Why do narcissists flourish in online dating?
So think about what online dating is. It's a construction of a narrative. It's a construction of a persona, quite frankly, right? When it's set up to do that. Right. And so you've got the grid of the pictures and it's perfectly curated, like the puppy, the Machu Picchu, the jumping off a cliff. Like, I don't know if there's some stock image place that they're like, you're supposed to have these pictures, but it also picture by a nice car, one with like looking like they love children or other vulnerable people. Like, they've got the whole thing. Right. So it's very curated and it's a numbers game. And remember, narcissistic people on the quest for supply, numbers are going to work better for them than investing so much in one person. And as a result, having the kind of flippant kind of texty text conversations that you tend to have at the beginning of an online dating relationship, there's no intimacy. There's no heavy lift there. Mm-hmm. It's very much about being witty and charming. They could be doing this with 5 people. Right? Very easily. In fact, probably even better, because the joke you told person 1, now you can sort of spruce it up for person 5, because it is superficial. It doesn't require that depth. And by definition, narcissistic people lack a capacity for deep, sustained intimacy. And I don't mean sexual intimacy. I mean the closeness that's the stuff of long-term committed relationships. And the superficiality of online dating in the beginning, I'm not saying it's always like that, but in the beginning, it absolutely plays on that strength.
And then how do narcissists know when they can reveal their true colors to the person? Because, for example, I think all of us, anyone listening, if a narcissist reveals their red flags on date 1, it's going to be like game over. Goodbye. Thank you very much. But the narcissist is so strategic in knowing when to reveal.
I'm going to beg to differ with you.
Oh, really?
I don't think this is as strategic as you think. I think that what is happening is they're really good at the superficial part. Mm-hmm. Right? Especially grandiose narcissistic folks. They're really good at that. I'm going to date five people. I'm going to stick lots of lines in the water. I'm going to see who's going to be able to give me what I want. They're going to drink up all the attention. I mean, the flirty fun. They're going to see who's giving them the most flirty fun back. So it's a bit of a, it's a reconnaissance mission for them. Once the relationship starts to enter a phase where there's real expectations, having to show up on time, having to be somewhere, having to account for someone else's needs, wants, or preferences, that's when this thing starts going wrong. And it's not because they're like, well, I'm going to keep it together until then. They think that their true colors are good colors. They don't think that it's like their true colors are bad colors. They think that they're great. There is a lack of self-awareness. Like, I'm so cool. I'm great. Like, I'm the nicest person. You're so lucky to be dating me. They believe it. They really, really believe it. Probably not down to that deep level of insecurity, but that's unconscious. So there's no touching that. But so this true colors thing isn't a thing. They think their true colors are fabulous.
Oh, that's so interesting. So I've been thinking of it as a very calculated, behavior where, okay, if I'm a narcissist, I've dated this person, I've shown my great colors.
No.
And then, so it's not there's like
no,
that.
They think they're great. Narcissistic people have been shown in the research to overestimate their level of empathy consistently. They honestly, their self-concept is I'm a cool, nice, generous, fun, smart person.
I'm mind blown. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll keep going then. I know you are the expert, so I'm not questioning you at all, but I'm just genuinely curious. So why would, if narcissists don't have this true colors or not, and narcissists are being themselves from the beginning, why would anyone end up dating a narcissist and staying in a long-term relationship with a narcissist?
So first of all, you can ask me, you can question me all you want. Expertise is only developed by being questioned, so I always appreciate that. Because what happens in the relationship is, and this is a very, very unique experience in these relationships, with narcissistic people, the charm, the charisma, the confidence, they can be very attuned in the beginning of the relationship, very attentive, very curious. You feel seen, you feel heard. A lot of people say, this is like, I've never had a relationship like this before. Like, this is a whole new experience, right? And as I put it, during that, we talk about the love bombing phase, right? It's really a phase of idealization and seduction. Mm-hmm. And that idealization and seduction looks different for everyone. For some cases, it's extravagant dates and presents and travel. In other cases, it's very attentive. It may not even be extravagant, but like a little, they'll remember little tiny things and they'll get them right. Attentive by text messaging and calling. They'll do errands for someone. They'll change the oil in their car. They'll take out the trash cans. They'll fix broken things in the house. For yet another person, it would be that the narcissistic person needs rescuing and help. And so a person who really loves rescuing will think that's almost love bombing. Like, oh, I finally found someone who just appreciates all the things I do. You see what mm-hmm. I'm saying? You take all those forms. As the relationship just when the relationship is almost settled into something where it's pretty clear that it is a relationship, now we start getting into the devaluation phase. And then the devaluation phase, it's not like you go from love bomb, I've changed your oil in your car, and here's a diamond on your pillow. It goes from what was really almost like 100% fun, good, yay, yay, 90% good, 10% bad. Then we start going to 80% good, 20% bad, 70% good, 30% bad. But in this slow burn down, you're still holding on to that good stuff. Once you hit 50-50, now we're really getting into the formation of the trauma bond, where the non-narcissistic person in the relationship is justifying and rationalizing the relationship on the basis of all that good stuff. There's a lot of confusion and there's a tremendous amount of self-blame. After all, this person was so good. And keep this in mind too, Erica. Attachment and love are basic human needs. We want them. We want to connect to other human beings, whether as partners, whether as family members, whether as friends. We value social connection. Most of us aren't willing to cut and run because somebody shows us some entitled behavior. Most of us aren't going to end a relationship because somebody was really mean to us one night. We go back to that deeper sense of like, well, they were really nice and we did have a good time and they do really understand me. We want to maintain attachments. Mm-hmm. And in that quest to maintain attachments, we justify, we rationalize, and above all else, we blame ourselves. We take responsibility. Maybe I'm not being nice enough. Maybe I'm being impatient. Maybe I'm not being realistic. Maybe I'm being too demanding. And so then we internalize And we keep trying harder. We try to be more perfect. But in that process, we stop making our needs known because we're starting to become clear. When we ask for stuff, it doesn't go well. Or if we question something, it doesn't go well. We don't think like, oh, gosh, this subjugating jerk who doesn't let me express my needs. We're like, it's going well. And then I say this and then it doesn't go well. So it's got to be me. That's why the book is called It's Not You, because that's what people start thinking. It's got to be me. But because by saying it's me, the relationship gets to sustain. But the problem is that now you get to 20% good, 80% bad, 10% good, 90% bad. Now you're in a very harmful relationship. That's not good for you psychologically. It's not good for your mental health, right? All of that's happening. Mm-hmm. But now a person has gotten into, again, this what we call this trauma-bonded structure, where you keep having the same arguments over and over again, and nothing ever gets resolved. You often use magical language to describe the relationship. Like, I don't know, like it's a, I don't know, like I've never felt like this before, but they're not able to give concrete reasons why this is a good relationship. It's magical, it's ephemeral, it doesn't make sense. And that's how people get stuck.
Have you ever noticed how everything is more expensive these days and prices never seem to stop going up? If you're a small business owner, rising costs can put a serious strain on your ability to do business efficiently and sustainably. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. You can reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, and it can be accessed from anywhere. You also cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. This is something I really love about NetSuite, the ability to be truly efficient and streamlined. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. From now until April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/Erica for all the details. That's netsuite.com/Erica. Erica is with a K. I'll put the link in the show notes. Okay, so I have some questions because you were my first ever guest I've had on the podcast twice. And so from our last conversation, I felt like I had a really good sense of what narcissists are. And I revealed to you that I think I was in a relationship with a narcissist for 4 years or so. And I've recently been thinking about this relationship and wondering how much of it was my fault. Because I do think I don't think that I was absolutely perfect and he was a narcissist and he was terrible. Sometimes I wonder, like, this is very honest. So, sometimes I wonder, looking back at it, if I was the problem too.
Why?
So, for example, one thing that we would always fight about is, it sounds petty talking about it, but he was very close to people at work. And at work, he would like massage the girls at work. And I was very upset about that. But now I'm looking back and I'm thinking, should I have been upset about that?
Okay. All right, Erica. Honey, we're doing some Erica intervention time. Okay. So now it's going to be Dr. Romani taught me because Let's put that into, because anyone listening to this, they've got some variation on the partner behaving inappropriately.
Okay.
Here's what you got to remember. You, Erica, were in a relationship with a person, okay? And imagine you, the two of you believed you loved each other. You are saying to this partner, this leaves me feeling uncomfortable. That's a vulnerability for you. To be in a loving relationship with another human being is to account for one's needs, for one's discomforts, within normal limits. Like, it's not like you said to him, I don't want you to go to your job, right? And reality check, a dude who's first of all, so retro, like, good luck with that in 2024. Okay, let's start there, number one. Number two, not okay, ever. I'm going to play judge and jury and God above, and I'm going to say, it's never okay. I don't care if this dude's in a relationship or not. It's not okay. I don't even care if these women said, I'd love a massage at work. Massages don't happen at work. That's why it's called work. Okay. But here's the thing. You look what you've even done is like, well, maybe I'm being unreasonable.
I know.
And that to me right there, that example is exactly what people do in these relationships all the time. They will say things like, oh, gosh, you know what? I am so priggish. I'm so ridiculous. So what if he's texting his ex-girlfriend? Like, I think it's great that they're friends. Do you? Do you really? And did you read the text? Or it's the, yeah, I know. I know I just had a baby, but like he misses golf. So what if he's gone on a golf weekend and I'm recovering from a C-section alone? Like, you know, he just wants to be with his friends. No. And so what happens is it's almost like these relationships have their own weather, like where nothing mm-hmm. kind of makes sense. But you are made to doubt in these relationships a very reasonable need. I don't want you to massage people at work. I don't want you to text someone from your past where it feels like it's unresolved. I don't want you to take a trip when I'm still in dire physiological need around this household, right? And people then are, because the narcissistic person is so masterful at leaving a person thinking that they're being unreasonable, they'll even say things like, well, I think most people wouldn't have a problem with this. So then we're being indexed against most people. And if we have even a tiny seed of self-doubt, we are going to blame ourselves and say, maybe I'm being difficult. And narcissistic people will also do this in realms related to intimacy and physicality and sexuality. They'll do things like they'll call a partner a prude for not wanting to engage in a behavior, in a sexual behavior or practice that they're not, you know, comfortable with yet. And the person will go, oh my gosh, maybe I am a prude. And this is where narcissism is really nefarious. Then the person will say, okay, I'm not a prude. I'm going to do this thing. And then the narcissistic person will shame them for engaging in that behavior. Mm. So it's really about not winning. But that, like, again, that kind of boundary you were asking for, please don't do this at work. It doesn't feel good, was so reasonable that there needed to be no doubt about that. And for me, if I had a wish, it would be, how do I help people see that your ask in a relationship is never unreasonable? And if the person can't meet it, then to give yourself permission to say, well, then this doesn't work.
Yeah. Okay. So there's another one then, and you can be honest with me, you can be the judge, but I was very suspicious and skeptical of his ex-girlfriends who he was still in touch with. So at least once, probably multiple times, I went through his phone. Mm-hmm. Now, how is that behavior?
Okay, so this is where we get into some really interesting murky territory, right?
Yeah.
Because sort of the law of the land is it's never right to check a partner's phone. Mm-hmm. That's the law of the land, right?
I feel embarrassed confessing this.
No, I've done it. It's funny. I've never checked a phone. That's why, but I'm not saying this from a good place. One time I accidentally checked a phone. So it makes sense. Like I went to grab the person's phone. I mean, the universe has ways, I'm telling you. And in this case, never checked a phone. Never, ever. And when the person's like, hey, grab my phone, we got to go. And I go to the literal moment I went to pick up the phone. It was this woman and she had removed her top. Baby, I miss you. And for the rest of my effing days, I will never forget the physiological sensation. It was like a freight train. It was like the sound of a freight train. My throat clenched up. I couldn't, like, as though I couldn't get air into my airway, and someone punched me in the gut. I will never forget that sensation. And I'm not a phone checker. I was then. And then I said, give me a minute.
Oh my God.
And it was like a nightmare from hell.
This was someone you were dating.
So my point is, phone checking is a really funny space. And let me talk to you too, my dear, about 20 scenarios I can tell you of separate people of the almighty cloud. The iCloud is such a funny thing because there's things showing up on every device in the damn house, short of your refrigerator. Now I think the refrigerators are smart refrigerators. So if you don't grab the message off the phone, it might show up on an iPad. Or it might show up on a computer, right? And I think it's usually you got to grab it on the phone first, otherwise it's going to show up on the iPad. And I can't tell, multiple situations. One comes to mind in particular where a lady was telling me how they had an iPad and they'd just come back on vacation. So probably the partner had connected those two things. And the kid had been fooling with the iPad. And she was putting the kid to bed. She's like, you got to go, give me the device. And so the kid's gone to brush the teeth and she picks up the device. And this guy was going to massage parlors or some such nonsense. And it was like picture after picture, text after text. She was not checking anything. It's just the way these things pop up. But because he wasn't checking his phone and he was on an airplane, he wasn't checking his phone. The stuff was jumping up onto the iPad. And so she saw everything. So when people tell me they've checked their phone, it's so easy, Erica, to say, to indict them, like, oh, what are you doing, Erica? You have no boundaries. You're so intrusive. To which I say to everyone, slow the hell down. I need some context here, okay? Are there people out there who sort of, if you will, inappropriately check phones? I suppose. But in the vast majority of cases, phone checking is usually preceded by a lot of shady stuff. It's not the go-to behavior for 95% of healthy people to say, I'm going to check my partner's phone, mm-hmm. right? Most people just don't care. They're like, and in fact, a friend of mine once did a straw poll out. We were on the street and we're like, let's just ask people. And we asked like 30 couples. 90% of them, I said, right now, would you give your partner your phone, let them check it and give them your password? 90% of couples said they would. 10% said they would not, right? So given that it's so ubiquitous, I think that some couples are thinking like, I don't even have a password, or I've known his password, or I'm always using his phone to text, that kind of thing, or their phone to text, whatever. Because that's so ubiquitous, when people feel compelled to check, it's usually a downstream effect of months and months and months of gaslighting and shady behavior. That's usually the case. I'm not saying it's always the case, but by the time it's happening, people say, well, that's a problem in the relationship. I said, they've got much bigger problems than phone checking. There's something really going down here. And this, Erica, is where people going through narcissistic, deceitful, betraying relationships are often really underserved by a lot of the existing writing about relationships. It's like a lot of relationships books are about two healthy people in a relationship, to which I'm like, why the hell do these people even need a damn book? Like, you know, you got it figured out. But what those books end up doing is often shaming people who are in really confusing, harmful relationships. And when I see that phone checking behavior, I'd never say to a client like, oh, how could you? I'd say, what's going on? Like, give me the lead up to that.
Yeah.
And what I will see is that they were being gaslighted mercilessly. And then they said, I can't take this. I need to know. And for some of them, it was the best thing they ever did, because they said, this is what got me out. This was it. And I'm like, if we did that, then this, whatever the so-called violation is. But I think we want absolute truths when it comes to relationships. And it ain't that simple.
What are three signs that you may be being gaslighted?
Okay, so one would be that you feel the need to write these long text messages and emails, like explaining everything. Because a lot of people think, like, when I talk to them, they're always questioning me and it's confusing. But you feel like if I put it all in writing, that they're actually going to read it and it'll make sense. Never going to work. And it's a real sign that you're probably being gaslighted. A second is when you feel like, oh, I wish I was recording them. I wish I could record this relationship. If you chronically feel like you wish you had a recording of the relationship or of your conversations with this person, that's another sign that you might be being gaslighted. And a third sign that you might be being gaslighted is that you feel this need to give this long disclaimer before you say anything. I just want to let you know, and I just want you to be sure, and I also know you mean this. And it's almost like you're trying to get ahead of everything that they could do. So you give this long disclaimer, and then they lose patience, and they still gaslight you.
What's the difference between being lied to versus being gaslighted?
It's a great question, because a lot of people think they're the same thing. You know, you're lied to as a person denying something happened that did. And lying is sort of a denial of evidence, right? Like, you say something didn't happen, it did. And if you show the liar evidence, they may not like it, but they'll probably go with you. Gaslighting is very different. It often starts with a lie. But the next piece is that the gaslighter is trying to destabilize you and dismantle you. So they'll not only lie, but then tell you there's something wrong with you. You're crazy, you're paranoid, you have memory problems, whatever it may be. So it's not as simple as them twisting reality and distorting the truth. It's always followed up with them also telling you that there's something very wrong with you. And you get lost in that and start to believe there is something wrong with you. So not only do they keep lying to you, you believe it's your fault.
When you were describing the looking at the phone and your heart stopping mm-hmm. and everything, that happened to me a separate time too, where mm-hmm. I was not going to check a phone. It was, I think I was doing something innocent, like turning off the alarm
yes.
or something.
Yes.
And I saw something I wish I wouldn't have seen. And it just was the same exact feeling, mm-hmm. just heartbreak. And I couldn't breathe, mm-hmm. but the lawyer in me, you know what I did? I grabbed my own phone and I started taking evidence screenshots.
Oh, yeah. I've known people do that. Right? That's so smart.
Right.
That's so smart. I think for some people in the, literally, I'm going to say betrayal trauma of that moment, their sympathetic nervous system is overtaken and they don't even have the wherewithal to think of this. And in some cases too, going back to that idea of how important attachment and love are, some people just don't want the pictures or the evidence because they want to be able to push it aside so they can stay in the relationship. Does that make sense? And having that evidence base makes it a lot harder.
Yeah, no, the lawyer and me, I went into private investigator mode. I was taking photos, mm-hmm. every angle. Yeah, it was traumatic, but yep. The problem with me though is that phone, this is again, probably revealing too much, but that phone behavior, so that narcissistic boyfriend, I checked his phone, I found what I
But okay, so let me go back
find.
To that. What led you to try? I can't imagine you were dating someone one day just decided to check his phone.
No, he was just so shady
That's
and
my
like
point.
Had all these girls around him and I was yep. convinced that there was something mm-hmm. going on and he was just too, I don't know, didn't respect my feelings and would always call me jealous and mm-hmm. like, yep. oh, you have no idea what you're saying. These are my, I have nothing to do with my ex anymore. And made me feel like I was just very over jealous girlfriend. And so, I don't know, I just wanted to confirm.
Yes, because you were being gaslighted.
Yeah.
So when we're being gaslighted, the quest, the drive, the desperation for evidence is incredibly compelling. We want to know. We want to, and we may not even know we're being gaslighted, but like you said, it's shady, it's confusing, it doesn't make sense. And so we are so driven to want that truth in some way, shape, or form. And that's why people get that. Honestly, I think in some ways, it's not even the gotcha as much as the, I want to feel sane. In fact, we had a YouTube video recently about this where the funny thing about a narcissistic relationship, it's not the broken heart that's nearly as difficult as the feeling crazy. I think feeling crazy is a bigger sin to make someone feel than a broken heart. Broken hearts heal. I'm telling you that they hurt, they're stressful, but it's the feeling crazy part that really does a number on a person.
You guys know that I love investing because you know that if your money is just sitting in a bank account, you're losing out to inflation every single year. That's why you invest it so that it grows for you, without you having to put in any extra work. I've been using an investing app called Webull for almost 4 years, and I had them do something really special for my listeners. By using my link to sign up today, you can get between 6 to 12 fractional shares for free. All you need to do is open an account and deposit any amount, even a dollar, to claim your free shares. So just by depositing a dollar, you'll get between 6 to 12 free fractional shares. And if you're wondering what to actually invest in, we talk all about investing in episode 28, so go ahead and listen to that episode. To claim your free shares through my special link, just go to ericataughtme.com/invest or click the link in the show notes. And it's Erica with a K. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/invest. If you're listening, let me guess. You have a passcode on your phone. And let me take another wild guess and say that you have a password on your computer. But why are so many of us okay just being completely unprotected online? We have no idea who has all our personal information online and whether it's the good guys or the bad guys who might be selling your information or worse. We're talking spammers, telemarketers, robocallers, people who want to know more about you and even where you live. My sister had her data leaked online, and because of that, her identity was stolen, and it was a nightmare to deal with. We had to lock down all her credit cards just for starters. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Aura, a sponsor of this episode. Aura can identify data brokers exposing your info and submit opt-out requests on your behalf. When I discovered it, I knew I had to try it out just to see if my information had been leaked online, which they let me see instantly after I signed up. And get this, for my audience, they're offering a free 14-day trial so you can see if your personal information has been leaked online. To find out now, go to ericataughtme.com/aura to claim your free 14-day trial. Erica with a K, and Aura is spelled A-U-R-A. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/aura. And I'll also leave the link in the show notes.
Yeah. And I remember that. I remember him yelling and just calling me crazy. Yep. And I mm-hmm. really started to believe it. And I mm-hmm. really felt like I was becoming what he mm-hmm. said I was.
Mm-hmm. And that is that indoctrination. And that's what the gaslighting and the manipulation do. You stay in something like this long enough, you feel small. You almost feel as though you've, in order to survive in this relationship, you simply are functioning in that other person's service, which means you don't complain about anything more. You almost become numb and dissociated. It's the only way it works in the long term until you know what it is. And then once you know what it is, listen, not everyone can leave these relationships. Sometimes people have young children. Sometimes they don't have the money to leave. Sometimes there are cultural or religious factors in play. And that's why I'm very, very clear in my books to never tell people, you gotta go. Mm-hmm. That sometimes it's just simply not an option. But it's very different to stay in one of these relationships and see it clearly than it is to stay in the relationship and remain completely walled off from what it really is, because that's where you become numbed and dissociated. But yeah. when you see it clearly, don't get me wrong, it's frustrating. It's a hard way to live. And a lot of people say, I have so much grief because this isn't even really a relationship. This is, and that might be what, that might be the catalyst to someone saying, I'm out. Now that I know what this is, I don't want to do this anymore. But we convince ourselves it's something else, something more. And that we're to blame. The day that whole paradigm shifts is the day a person makes very different kinds of choices and decisions.
So I had maybe 6 or 7 months ago, a girl that I used to be close to in college, we were talking and I had already had my suspicions about her boyfriend being a narcissist. Mm-hmm. I mean, from our conversation now, I felt like I was an expert narcissist. So I knew right away when she was telling me things like he would not let her hang out with certain friends mm-hmm. and just the behaviors. I knew that this was a narcissist, but in this conversation, it was revealed to me that not only is he a narcissist, but he was also abusing her physically. Mm. And I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I had never been in a situation mm-hmm. where someone had confided in me, given me that. And so I felt like I did the wrong thing in that conversation where I said, you have to leave him. Like, this mm-hmm. is a clear line where it's not okay, this behavior. He mm-hmm. cannot hit you. This is not okay. But I actually went to counseling right after that because right away I wanted to figure out how am I supposed to best support her mm-hmm. and learn that that is not what I was supposed to say. I was mm-hmm. not supposed to tell her to leave.
First of all, you did it from a loving place, yeah. right? Someone you care about was in harm. The only thing we ever want for someone we care about is their safety and their well-being. So I hate to say that you say you did the wrong thing. You did a loving thing. You're not a trained counselor. Does yeah. that make sense? So let's show some grace to yourself and, you know, that you... When to hear someone's you love being harmed, all we want to do is get them out of it. So the question some people might be having as they listen to this, well, why is that the wrong thing to say? It's very likely that this friend you would talk to is trauma bonded, right? Is that they cannot see what this is. That many people are in trauma bonded in relationships, even as they start to see it, Erica, will say, okay, I get it. This isn't healthy. But the idea of leaving this relationship is giving me a panic attack, right? So they're having a physiological reaction to ending something harmful, even when they see it. And it sounds like the person you'd known from way back when, they didn't even know that this was harmful, right? But they do know that something had happened and the justifications mount up. And we've known this from the domestic violence literature for years. And then when you're talking about things like isolation, the likelihood of getting support gets less and less. Now, people might wonder, well, so Why don't we tell them to stay? Because it leads a person to sometimes double down. They're even more likely to defend the relationship, to say, no, it's not as bad as I made it out to be. And it's really actually really a good relationship. Like, they'll start to blame themselves. And they will even try to do sort of like a PR job for the partner. Like, no, I'm painting this totally wrong. And by the time
they're
done.
That's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm,
yep. By the time they're done, where the harm comes from is when we say you got to leave, they might actually defend the partner so much that they're buying into an even deeper narrative structure. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So as a therapist, somebody's telling me that, the questions I'd say is like, how are you doing? Like, how are you feeling? And to get sort of open up the emotional piece of this. And then get to the safety, like, are you safe? Do you have a place to go if this were ever to get worse? Not leave, but like, and then you get them to talk about that. And then you get to the place of, that wasn't okay. I just want you to know that wasn't okay. That's different than you need to leave. Mm-hmm. Because what you've now done is you've inserted, like, I've just watched this, right? And I'm saying that just is a reality check. That's not okay behavior. And I understand it's also really complicated. So now you're letting them know, not okay. I'm not pushing you to do anything you don't want. I am here. But by dropping that little tidbit of it's not okay, you have dropped some plausible doubt into the situation. So you're an attorney. So you know what I'm trying to get at here, mm-hmm. right? But our heart pulls us to say, I want you out of this. And in an ideal world, that's exactly what would happen. But if a person feels they're being pulled out of something before they're ready to go, the odds are that they're going to go back. And then each time they go back, it's narcissistic abusers often get worse and more isolating.
So what should I do then?
I always tell folks what we never want to do is you always want to stay in touch. Because remember, the narcissistic partner is always going to try to distance a partner from supportive, validating voices because it makes their job harder of trying to power, dominate, and mm-hmm. gaslight someone. By whatever means possible, you reach out. And I always say one thing that you really can do a favor to someone who's in a narcissistic relationship, don't keep talking about the relationship. Mm-hmm. Allow their subjective reality to remain alive by talking to them about the things that matter to them. Because believe it or not, what you're doing is that kind of fading part of identity that goes away in a narcissistic relationship. You're giving it some life. You continue to pump blood through it because their partner does not care about their subjective self. So allow that self, whether it's a professional self, whether it's a friendship self, you bring them back to hobbies. Like you even say to them, remember how much we used to love doing da-da-da? You want to go do that sometime? You keep bringing them back to the life they had before the relationship. But I think a lot of people, they're unsettled when people are in these relationships. And there's a real risk. Not only might a partner be isolating them from everyone else, but other people start to isolate because they feel helpless. You don't have to, you're not their shrink, you're not their life coach, you're their friend. And the greatest good we can do to someone who's going through this is stay in the game with them. Mm. And you don't need to keep talking about the relationship. In fact, talk about the stuff that comprised all they were before they got into this mess.
That's interesting because I was feeling like I should bring it up more mm-hmm. so that she can feel like she can open yep. up with me. But I should not bring it up anymore.
You don't bring it up. If she brings it up, then you listen and you empathize and you find that moment. Like that's not okay. Are you okay? Because I'm worried. You can say things like, I'm worried about you. This feels like it's taking a toll on you. How are you coping? You're drawing answers. But what I always say is we're trying to create doubt that this is a healthy relationship.
But what if she stays in there for the next year and there's no opportunity for me to remind her that this is not normal because she doesn't bring it up?
The odds of that happening are almost zero because it's too much at the top of her mind. And I'll be frank with you, even if she doesn't bring it up, but she continues spending time with you and feels held and validated and strong, you've still given her something that otherwise would have completely disappeared. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like I said, you're putting a blood flow through a part of her that was going to die if she didn't have someone reminding her that there's a self in her that's separate from this relationship.
Mm. And when does someone in a narcissistic relationship realize that they should get out? Or what does it take for them to realize?
I mean, Erica, that's a big question, right? Because it's some people never realize. I'm going to be honest with you. Some folks stay in the darkness forever. It's too much to see, right? To me, seeing is everything. It doesn't mean you leave. But the seeing means we might lift some of the self-blame. It's uncomfortable because you're recognizing like, oh, I'm in something icky. Life's not perfect. And selling yourself that this is an actual love story is actually more harmful than I'm in a very unhealthy relationship. I'm very clear on my reasons I'm staying, and I'm going to give myself permission to develop some sort of form of subjective universe outside of this relationship. Like I said, not perfect. It sure as hell isn't the stuff of a Disney movie, but it's much more workable than aren't we in love? And when a person lives in that form of denial, they're going to get physiologically ill. Right? Mm-hmm. So what's that penny drop moment? What's that rock bottom? It depends. For some people, it could be a certain level of betrayal, multiple infidelities, financial abuses or misusing family finances. It could be them harming a child. It could be them. We all have a line in our mind. We all have something we consider a rock bottom, right? It could be a significant public shaming. It's going to be different for everyone. And some people will even think, if he ever cheats on me, I'm leaving. And even that's not enough. Then they're still finding, oh, they didn't really have sex. They just made out. And so someone might even move their own goalposts. This is why, though, in my book, throughout my writing, what I've talked with you, the piece that I always come back to, and I'm unrelenting on this, is this is never going to change. So what I'm telling you now, you can make your excuses. You can have your reasons. But I'll tell many a client, I never tell them to leave. It's not a thing to me. I need them to choose for themselves. That's what's important. But I always say to them, how would you feel? Or how do you think you're going to feel? How are you going to make a decision? Because I'm about to tell you, none of this is ever going to change. This is it. A lot of people look at me wide-eyed and saying, what do you mean, therapy? I'm like, this is it. And they'll usually say, can I have a week? I'll get back to you. Mm-hmm. But it's, remember, sometimes for them, decades, lifetimes have been built around this idea that this can get better. So I've taken that away. We've removed that from the equation. That's the game changer. So when the person is with an unfaithful partner, we'll use that mm-hmm. as an example, because that's more of a manifest example. Not only with an unfaithful partner, but a partner who also gaslights them about it and is dismissive and contemptuous. To me, I'd still consider it a win if I could get that person to see what this is clearly, right? It's very hard then to stay, because some people say, well, it's really gross to have to stay if I know that he's doing this to me. So they want to stay in a denial, but that's what's going to get them sick and put them in an early grave. So it's the getting them to see it. But some people, the getting folks to see it, that's the tough part. And I think most people do get there, but it can take decades. It can absolutely take decades and decades. And I always say, some people who can't handle it, they'll turn away from my work and they'll go back to the sort of the woo-woo magic love kind of guidance. They'll come back this way again mm-hmm. and they'll learn about this again. But sometimes they'll see their own children enter a narcissistic relationship as adults, and that will end up becoming the wake-up call. But how long does it take? Anywhere from 6 months to 60 years.
I mean, that's exactly what she was saying to me, is I believe that he can change. Like, I think he's going to go to therapy and he'll change. He'll be different. And it was a one-time thing.
Right. See, the challenge is that people will say that to me and I'll say, have they articulated to you what they think the problem is? And they'll say, I'll change. And to which my question will be, you're going to change. What are they going to change? Do they know what needs to be changed? Oftentimes that promise of change is that thing called future faking. I'll change just to keep you on the chain, right? You're a good source of supply. I don't want you to go anywhere. So I'll change is usually a future fake. Now, if a person says, I am not being sufficiently empathic, I am not attuned to you, I have not been respectful, and it is not okay, and I am going to go work on this. Okay, but that's probably not a narcissistic person if they like got kind of self-awareness. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So the sad thing is sometimes people will lose 6 months, years, 5 years to a person saying, I'm going to go to therapy. Because you can't expect someone's going to go to therapy and be better next week, right? So now you've probably bought at least another 6 months into the relationship. And then they'll say, oh, it's really hard to find a therapist, or I'm really, really busy. Another 6 months, they haven't even found the therapist. And this game can go on for a very, very long time.
How do you know that narcissists cannot change?
Because there's no clinical evidence supporting it, right? So that's where what we don't have is a single randomized clinical trial in the literature of a treatment for therapy for people who have been formally assessed with narcissistic personality styles, randomly assigned to two, three conditions, one group not getting treatment, others getting a certain treatment. That doesn't exist. So anything we know about therapeutic change in narcissistic folks is what we either call case-based research, or it's not randomized clinical stuff. So we don't know what, these are probably very motivated individuals, right? Mm. So we don't have an evidence base. That's number one. Number two, and this probably isn't worth anything, I've been doing this for a long time. I haven't seen it. What I've seen is I've seen clients create, recreate, recreate the same cycles even after they've dropped out of therapy. I see them keep it together for a while and then go, as soon as things in life aren't going the way they want, they fall apart again. Whatever change happens, Erica, and I'm not saying there's no change, okay? But there's small C change and there's big C change, okay? And by big C change, I mean so much change that a person has engaged in the kind of self-awareness and more than anything, self-regulation. They catch themselves. They think before they speak. They have their rage in check. They have techniques they use instead of raging out. That kind of stuff, that kind of capital C change, that's, I have not seen evidence of that. Small C change, like maybe greater attempts to apologize. They keep doing the bad things, but maybe they apologize a little bit more. Maybe their rage has, the volume's turned down a little bit, but they're still kind of manipulative and gaslighting. They're still entitled. Enough change that a therapist might notice because we're watching behavior at a minutia level. I don't know it's even enough that a partner would notice, right? Because we're not bringing frustrations to them in therapy the way a partner might be complaining about a broken dishwasher or why'd you come home so late, that kind of thing, right? So we're not testing the person in the same way. We can see small C change. I'll see it in I've worked with narcissistic clients where we got them to the point where they showed up on time to therapy regularly. Mm-hmm. They paid their fee on time regularly. They were willing to maybe a little bit more emotional heavy lifting in therapy. They see those changes. Right. But that doesn't necessarily mean, it's almost like what happens in the lab. Let's say you send someone off to some sort of health camp for 2 weeks where you have to get up at 8 a.m. or 6 a.m, even 5 a.m. And you have to run and you have to eat a certain kind of breakfast. And then you go to a meditation class and you eat a certain kind of lunch and then you do another. And they do that for 2 weeks. Right, under those controlled circumstances. They're not going to work or anything. And then they come back from wellness camp and they're back into their schedule and the kids and the routines and the job, and it all falls apart. Mm-hmm. So I think that under the most controlled circumstances of therapy, we might see some changes. And I know there's people out there who would disagree with what I'm saying. They'd say, no, I've seen the changes. But you also have to remember too, the kind of therapy a person needs to make the changes, which is once, maybe twice a week therapy with a highly trained therapist who can actually handle this kind of client and not feel, you know, bulldozed by them, at least 12 to 18 months of therapy at that frequency, that's out of pocket. We're talking now, we're into the tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars. What, 2% of the United States can afford that? 5% of the United States can afford that? It's a pretty small percentage. And commit to it. And we know that the research suggests that narcissistic people are 61% more likely to drop out of therapy, especially when the rubber meets the road. That's the evidence base. Because one of the challenges with the narcissistic personality is that lack of self-reflective capacity. And they also don't think they're doing anything wrong, right? So they're not coming into therapy saying, oh, I said the wrong thing. Most of the time when I've worked with narcissistic clients, they would use therapy as a complaining session. Mm. This is my victimhood of the past week. Can you believe how much was done wrong to me? All these terrible things. How come I suffer so much? That's what they were bringing into therapy week over week. Not the, you know, taking responsibility of and trying to really do the deep dive and pay attention.
Are there certain factors that influence why someone might be able to leave a relationship quickly when they start to see red flags or are physically harmed versus someone else who may not see a way out?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this is the thing that the domestic violence research has been exploring for 50 years, you know, since the 70s, and this research really began. It's very complicated nested factors because there are some people, I agree with you, Erica, the first time someone puts hands on them, they are out. Everything I'm saying here is statistical and probabilistic, right? It's very possible that that person to whom that happens They have what we call good social capital around them. There is a soft place for them to land, a family to go to, friends who will take them in. There's some form of resource. There's safe places to live. That's one piece of it. The other, and it's very likely that those people also did not grow up in a way where there was any normalization of emotional abuse, verbal abuse, physical abuse. So this really represented something of like a what the actual kind of a situation. And they were willing and able to hear the people who might be like a therapist. They'd say, okay, this is what happened. And they could see the therapist's reaction and say, I know I need to get out. And there's a place to go to. Mm. We always forget this about people who go through so many physically abusive relationships. So many people have nowhere to go. Okay, so that's number one. We can also dig into historical factors, though, because, you know, everyone says, are there certain things that make people vulnerable to entering narcissistic relationships? No, I think we're all vulnerable because they're charming, charismatic, confident, all the stuff, shiny stuff I told you about. But the getting stuck is the issue. That's the big question. Who gets stuck? There's some different characteristics we know about. Certainly growing up in a family where there was any form of where a person was, again, they had a narcissistic parent, where their needs were shamed, where they told they were selfish and ungrateful, where they were devalued, where they were invalidated. All of that definitely is going to put a person at risk for feeling not enough, of taking on self-blame, of believing that attachment means that I have to give up on myself to keep someone close, right? So there's that piece to it. And so having either a narcissistic or other form of abusive family relationship, that is going to be a risk factor for getting stuck. Having a history of trauma would be a risk factor for getting stuck. Somebody who has a propensity for being a rescuer has a likelihood of getting stuck, saying like, maybe I can help them through this. I know they don't mean this. Because remember, narcissistic relationships have a lot of their good days. There's that love bombing stuff, all of that. So people who have a tendency to want to fix, who want to rescue, they're at risk because they're going to say, I can help them. I don't like the idea of quitting someone. That it actually literally goes against one's own values, that you believe in people and say, I can't say I love someone and then walk out on them. So that's one group. People who believe in forgiveness. Like, I believe in forgiveness. It's a core value for me. Those folks can often get stuck and keep forgiving and forgiving and sometimes to their ultimate demise. People who are very optimistic and positive. I believe everyone has that capacity to make a full change, not understanding how the dynamics of a personality style like narcissism. Those people are vulnerable to getting stuck. So you can see that there's a lot of things that might be at play that would keep someone in, like after they were physically harmed one time, and say, that's not enough. There's too much other good stuff here. Stuff happens. And what the big risk too is, if a person knows the history, the narcissistic person's history, and they came to find out that there was some adversity in that narcissistic person's history, that the narcissistic person themselves had endured some form of abuse, but they were told that the narcissistic person had gone through some form of adversity, then, and you have any of those other characteristics I talked about, forget about it. That will become the grounds on which I'm going to show them what real love looks like. I'm going to teach them that people don't run away from them. And on top of that, if the narcissistic person tell them, everyone always leaves me. Well, there's a reason everyone always leaves you, but everyone always leaves me. My mother left, my father left. People don't want to be the one who leaves. So you throw all that into a stew and you're starting to see how actually somebody leaving after one time, the first time they're physically abused, to me, that seems incredibly unlikely. Mm-hmm. All that other stuff seems a hell of a lot more likely to me.
When you were describing the potential childhood of someone who ends up in a relationship with a narcissist and chooses to stay, that sounds similar to what I know of people who end up being narcissists, where people who end up being narcissists often, I believe, and have traumatic childhoods. So one, is that correct? And then two, what differentiates the people who end up as narcissists themselves versus the people who end up in relationships with narcissists and choose to stay in those relationships?
Right. So one thing that helps is to understand the multiple pathways by which people become narcissistic. And then we'll talk about why those pathways actually can lead to multiple other things too. There's a term we use in development. It's called multifinality. And multifinality means that there's no, we want things to be so neat and tidy when it comes to human development, and it doesn't work that way. There's 100 pathways coming in at the same time. And so what that means is that even in one family and 3-4 kids being raised with same parents, pretty similar conditions economically and otherwise, one kid can turn out narcissistic and three may not. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about, there's just two pathways. One is that pathway of adversity that gets people to being narcissistic, right? Neglect, abuse, adversity, not being seen, not being heard, and all that. Then there's also the second pathway is one of overindulgence. This is sort of the spoiled child narcissism. You're more special than any other child. You are the chosen child. These are kids who are not taught to self-soothe or self-regulate. The parents fix everything for them. The child is really grown up, raised with very few limits. They're materially overindulged. One thing they don't get is often a strong emotional core. They're not actually taught how to emotionally regulate and all of that. The parents are nowhere to be found when there's emotional need. And then, of course, there's a third pathway of what I call modeling, is of a child watching a narcissistic parent being entitled, but they usually fall into that second group, all right? So in that first group, that adversity group, that pathway is actually, narcissism is not the most likely outcome from that. It is an outcome, but it's not the most likely outcome. The more likely outcomes are things like complex PTSD, anxiety, mood issues, issues around self-esteem, self-worth. That's usually where we see it go, all right? So what then would lead, are there other what we call moderating factors, other things that would make it turn out to be more narcissism? Probably the one thing that might be the most meaningful is something we call temperament, okay? Temperament is what we'd call the biological part of personality. It's why even in a little kid, we might see them have an expression that resembles an aunt they haven't even met. That these genetic elements of personality, there's parts of that can be carried. And there are certain temperamental styles. They're sometimes called more externalizing styles. These are kids who might act out more, be more attention-seeking. As infants, they might be more difficult to soothe. These externalizing, difficult to soothe, some people would call them difficult temperaments. These kids don't always have the nicest experience in the world early on because they're a handful, right? Parents are getting exhausted. Caregivers are getting frustrated. And these are kids that might hear a lot more invalidation, right? So that repeated invalidation on top of that difficult temperament, that is believed to be actually more of a clear-cut path to a narcissistic personality. Anecdotally, I can say that when I have worked with clients and been able to get a collateral report from like a parent or someone who knew them as a child, invariably their characterization of them was as a difficult kid, couldn't sit still, always asking for attention, very demanding, very different than their siblings who were much more quiet and yielding. And we like yielding kids, right? They're easier to raise. So that temperament piece is probably the money shot in all of this. And it's tough because these kids don't always have the easiest path, you know, and I'm acknowledging that because they are children. But even then, some kids with difficult temperaments who even have adversity don't always go on, but it's a lot more likely. And there's research, it's from the 80s, but some of this research suggests that these kids who had difficult temperaments at like 8 or 9 years old, they're much more likely to have relationship problems in their 30s. Mm. So there's definitely some predictive data in that direction. So when we take that all in total, if I were to say what the factor is, it's probably that temperament piece. It's still not the most common pathway. So yes, there can be similar backstories, and yet one person's turning out narcissistic and more others are turning out, like I said, anxious, showing patterns consistent with complex post-trauma, issues maybe with over-regulation, poor self-worth, that kind of thing. That's probably more common than the narcissistic person emerging out of that. But yeah, they may have very similar backstories. The difference is the narcissistic person will be more skillful at using that to construct a victimized narrative and not take responsibility.
How common is physical abuse in relationships with narcissistic people?
So it's a really good question. And so it's sort of, it's a strange bi-directional thing. I would actually argue that most narcissistic people are not physically abusive in relationships. I think it's what we see is very much the emotional abuse. Remember, narcissism is on a spectrum. And I think at that lower and even the moderate end, we don't see physical abuse. I think it's more at the severe malignant end is where we tend to see more physical aggression. You know, the big question's always been, though, what about people who physically abuse in relationships? If that's who we're looking at, are they narcissistic? I would be willing to hazard a guess that almost all, well over 90, 95% of people who engage in violent behavior, physically violent behavior in relationships, are narcissistic. And why do I say that with such sort of zeal? This is not random violence. This is violence being perpetrated against someone who you are claiming to have loved. And you have the capacity to engage in physical violence. Well, people say, well, what if they grew up seeing it? I said, well, then that might be why they're narcissistic, but they're still probably narcissistic. You see what I'm saying? History, just because someone has a history, they still could have the narcissistic personality, which would still describe the violence. There was a study that came out in 2021 by Sophie Kierwick and Brad Bushman at Ohio State University. They did a meta-analysis of over 400 studies. It was one of the phenomenal study, and they showed with absolute consistency that narcissism is associated with all forms of violence, verbal violence, online violence, physical violence, pick a violence. It was associated with violence, associated with aggression. That relationship is well-founded. So when you show me a group of people who are physically violent in relationships, we're talking 90, 95% narcissism, maybe psychopathy if you want to throw that in the mix, but these are antagonistic people. Mm. They're so thin-skinned and so poorly regulated that they have no problem physically lashing out at someone and then making up some sort of cockamamie narrative about why they did it, okay? But the vast majority of narcissistic people are not physically abusive. When people are in relationships where they are being physically abused, they are likely definitely up against narcissism, very likely other mental health stuff, potentially substance and alcohol use could be on board as well. And people say, well, no problem then. Let them get treated for addiction. Let them go into therapy. Great, great, great. Because what happens, you do that, you clear, let's say they get sober. Let's say they get therapy for something else. The narcissism is like an unyielding bedrock. And if I were to pick the thing that's most associated with that violent behavior, I'd say it's the narcissism, because they can't cope with frustration, with someone standing up to their authority. They personalize what people are doing. They'll say, you're out to get me, and I'm going to show you. It's that power, dominance, that motivation is so strongly felt. And to the degree that's coming out of the narcissism, you can clear everything off the deck, but that thin skin provocation is still very much going to be in place.
I guess when the narcissist is on that end of the spectrum, the severe end where they are engaging in abuse, mm-hmm. physically abusive behavior, that's very clear cut. But what if this narcissist is more on the less severe end and someone is in a relationship with this person and not sure whether this is a clear cut narcissist? What should they be looking out for?
When it's at the lower end, listen, even at the severe end, Erica, that's not necessarily manifest early in the relationship. Does that make mm-hmm. sense? So it's not as though just because it's more severe narcissism that it's going to show up more earlier. Not at all. It just means that when it shows up, it could be more harmful. But at the more mild, at the mild end of the narcissistic spectrum, you're talking about people who are shallow and emotionally immature and ridiculous. These are people who are obsessed with take 72 pictures of me so I can edit the best one. And they're grown-ass people who are walking around the world like adolescents, right? I think that the harm of those folks comes when the relationship has bigger stakes. Like, for example, you're trying to raise children with them and they're still conducting themselves like a child. Like, no, I can't change a diaper. I'm playing a video game. Like, that's just, again, I won't even say it's harmful, but it's definitely going to be exhausting. Mm-hmm. In the moderate end of the spectrum, you're definitely seeing relationships that are more emotionally harmful. And that's definitely probably going to show up as the devaluation is more obvious. I think in the milder end, the devaluation is going to be more that you find yourself listening to them and making modifications in your life for them or making your schedule work for them. But when you ask them for one thing, they will often selfishly not do it. Like again, like a adolescent kid who doesn't want to empty the dishwasher. That's what that feels like. But at the moderate end, it feels more manipulative. And that stuff will start showing up. That's what you're going to see. It's more of the manipulative, contemptuous, dismissive, poor frustration tolerance, getting angry when things don't go their way sort of stuff.
In It's Not You, what is the one thing that you want people to absolutely take away from it?
Mm-hmm. It's not your fault, thus the title, and you can heal past this, that this will not forever define you, but you got to be able to know what it is. And the most painful thing is this is a relationship for many years or much of your life, you believe, with someone you loved, and have to be able to look at it through a very different lens, radically accept it, and make very different choices where this relationship is concerned. And once you're able to do that, you will slowly be cut free from it and you will heal. And mm-hmm. It will happen.
I know that some relationships are easier to leave than others. Meaning if you are in a romantic relationship with someone, yes, you have the choice to leave. But you do not have the choice to choose who your mother is or who your sister is or who your brother is. What do you do in those cases where you are blood related to a narcissist and... do you make the choice to go no contact?
People go make the choice all every day. Many people make the choice to say, I can't do this anymore. This is harming me. Families are tough because a family might be comprised of some people you want to maintain contact with and some you wish you'd never see again. And it might be the price of admission of seeing those people you want to have contact with is tolerating the one you don't. It becomes more about disengagement. No contact is a very heavy-handed strategy and one that very few people can employ. Disengagement's different. You no longer really have meaningful conversations with them. You have realistic expectations. You know what's coming. There's a lot of eye rolling. It's also about honoring your body and saying, okay, I am now feeling sick being around them. I got to get out of this. I got to step away. I've got to leave. You know, I teach people, like, what does that limit feel like when you're in it? How has it felt for you? And when that starts coming, it's really time to find a way to really, really disengage. There's a grief when it's your parent because you realize there's no do-over on childhood. People feel that they've had something stolen from them, that they wish they could have had a more loving relationship with the parents. A lot to give up on. But many people will say to me, you know, I guess in some ways I gave up on that a long time ago. And even that concept of sort of chosen family, that people will say, I ended up finding that there was people in my community I've grown close to, that I have friends who are older than me that have had parental roles. It's different. It's different. But families are very, very tough for this reason. We stigmatize people who experience familial estrangement as though there's something wrong with a person who is somehow disengaged from a family. All of those things make it more complicated when it's a family. But some people say, listen, I moved 5,000 miles away from my family. Not engaging with my family is easy enough. But physically moving away is often not enough. You psychologically have to break those ties. Seeing it clearly is tough. A lot of people feel disloyal. They feel like they're the problem. And families are often chock full of enablers who will pathologize the person who is putting a hot, bright, white light on that narcissistic dynamic as though, like, come on, like, we all wanted to stay in the darkness. Please don't make us see this. It's that. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes the person who disrupts the status quo.
Somewhat of a selfish request because I'm hoping my college friend will listen to this episode. What would you say to her?
I would say, I know there's good parts of this relationship you want to hold on to, but what's happening in this relationship is not okay.
Thank you. The positive ending here is that I hope that people will listen to this episode. Mm-hmm. I know the one that we did last year was so impactful, changed so many lives. I hope people will listen to this episode and realize that it's not them. Mm-mm. They're not alone. Mm-mm. And narcissists cannot change.
It's not them. It's not you. You're not alone. And stop investing the best of yourself on the idea that someone else is going to change. Invest in yourself. And also know that healing doesn't mean leaving. So for people listening to this who are saying, I'm not going to contact with my family, or I am not leaving this relationship, that's okay. You don't need to. You just need to see it clearly and engage with it differently. And read the book, because it's all the answers are in there.
One of my friends, I was at dinner the other night, and he said, everyone falls into three categories. They're either driven by power, fame, or money. Where do you think narcissists fall?
All three. I mean, what's challenging is I think what your friend's trying to argue is maybe one is more than the other. For me, what's hard about that conjecture is, to me, money and power are conflated, heavily conflated. They're so highly correlated that I don't see how you pull those two apart. Because you have enough money, then you have all the power, right? It's very rare for a person to want to pursue power without money. That doesn't even make sense. Then it would almost mean that they've already got the money, but then they were. So I don't know that I like that sort of split of three. Fame is a little different. Fame can carry power, but fame is to me, that's very much a narcissistic drive, because then everyone will love me, but not all narcissistic people want to be famous. They would be very content with the power that they would derive through money. If I had to pick one, I'd say power. But I think because power is a proxy for those other two things, to be very honest with you, I really, really do. But I think if I had to choose one, it would be the power, because power is the ultimate defense. It's a defense against vulnerability. It's a defense against shame. It's a defense against insecurity. Because if you have power, then no one can better you, right? That's really what it is. You do get to control the narrative. But I think money and fame allow people to do those things.
So the podcast is called Erica Taught Me, but really today was all about Dr. Ramani Taught Me. So what do you want people to walk away saying, Dr. Ramani taught me this?
Dr. Ramani taught me that I, like all human beings, have the right to my needs, wants, feelings, beliefs, and values, and to an identity of my own, and to have those things without them being shamed and being called selfish or ungrateful or greedy.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this. And also, I want to say congratulations to Dr. Ramani. This has just become a New York Times bestseller. So if this resonated with you, I would really love if you could pick up a copy and read it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed the episode, please take a moment to leave a review. It really helps support what we're doing. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next Tuesday on a brand new episode of Erica Taught Me.